The establishment didn't want the idea of a future king of England having a Muslim half-brother or sister. Mm.
There's only one conspiracy theory, as far as I'm concerned, to do the death of Diana, and that is a conspiracy that's grown up that it was an accident.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Britain's housing crisis is really Britain's housing racket. 65 million people on 65 million acres of land, which is a free gift to mankind. Why does a house cost up to 100 times to buy, and what it costs to build? In terms of materials and labour, a basic three-bedroom semi-detached house can cost around £60,000 and £70,000 to build. If it sits there for 200 years, that works out about £12 a month. But many people, particularly in London, are paying 100 times that and more. So, apart from the usual bankster suspects, who's profiteering from the housing racket? Why this obsession with pumping up the housing bubble? How did we get from the earth being a free gift to mankind to a price where tens of millions can't afford any of it, and around a million people in Britain today are left homeless? Plus, rumours around and counter-rumours about Hinkley Point Power Station. What's happening to the waste from Hinkley A, which was decommissioned in 2000? Is Hinkley B really a bomb factory, as we heard from Nikki Clark from the campaign group Stop Hinkley last week? And will Hinkley C ever be built? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Martin, I think we'll probably start with that now. This week we've seen the commencing of a bombing campaign by the Russians over in Syria.
Indeed, and it's a very fraught geopolitical situation.
Is that all you've got to say about it?
Well, I mean, one of the things I was reading, that it makes it less likely that Cameron will go to the British Parliament and ask for permission for the RAF to bomb inside Syria, even though they already are bombing inside Syria. Because the situation has become more complicated, and some of the Tory MPs in particular that he needs are not convinced that the case has been made that it's going to do any good or could lead, in fact, to a situation where the RAF are facing off with the Russian Air Force.
The accusation pretty much straight away has been that the areas that the Russians have been bombing have not been actually ISIS strongholds.
Well, what the Russians have said is that they are bombing all terrorist organisations trying to overthrow the government in Damascus.
I mean, isn't it fair to say that they're bombing whoever it is that might be attacking their ports on the Mediterranean?
Well, I mean, they are in alliance with the Syrian government, so they're attacking the Syrian government's enemies. Wall Street Journal this week was saying this is terrible. The Russians are attacking the moderate rebels of Al-Qaeda. They actually said that. So the Russians just said, well, why is Al-Qaeda moderate? They're only moderate compared to ISIL. But the Wall Street Journal actually referred to the Al-Nusra Front, which is the local branch of Al-Qaeda, as the moderates. The fact of the matter is that there are no moderate rebels in Syria. There are various Islamist factions, some more extreme than others, all of which are supposedly, have been working hand in glove with Western intelligence services and with the Saudis.
Also on our story to do with Hinkley Power Station, I'm joined on the line now by nuclear engineer, retired John Large. Hi, John, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, sorry, I can't hear you very well.
Can I just ask you about what your thoughts are about the progress of Hinkley C and whether ultimately you think it's ever going to be built?
Well, there are a number of factors on Hinkley C. I mean, the primary one is this, is whether the government has got enough confidence in the Chinese to actually back the project in terms of cash injection. You're talking about a project that's going to cost 20 or so billion pounds in the long run, and it's a long haul. It's going to occur right up until about 2023. That's the headlines that have been occurring. But underlying that are a number of difficulties. One of the difficulties is the strike price, the very expensive, nearly £100 per megawatt generated strike price that the government has negotiated with EDF. In effect, it's guaranteeing EDF over the next 30 or so years, when this station comes on to generation, if it does, a price that is roughly twice the price we pay for the present for electricity. So it's offering the operator, EDF, twice the price of the current generating cost. And underlying all of this is the technical aspects of what's occurred in France and in China. What has happened, there's the identical reactor, virtually identical reactor, is called the EPR, the European Pressurized Reactor. That's the type of reactor that's going on at Hinkley C. They've been built in France. There's been one being constructed in France at a place called Flamanville, down in Normandy in that area, and there's four being built at Tashuan in China. Well, we know the one at Flamanville has developed a major technological, in fact a metallurgical problem with its pressure vessel. This is an enormous piece of steelwork, weighs about 700-800 tons, and it's developed what's called a carbon anomaly. I mean, let's not go into technical details. And what it means is, because in the manufacturing, particularly the forging stage of this particular pressure vessel in France, the components were built in France, means that there's excessive amounts of carbon, free carbon, out of solution in the grain boundaries of the material, the steel. What this has an effect to do is makes it very brittle. So instead of being a ductile material steel, it becomes rather a glassy material. It's very difficult for engineers to actually determine when it will fail in terms of our pressure load overload. So the problem is this, that the French nuclear safety regulator has dictated to EDF, the same operator in France as in Britain, that it must demonstrate the wholesomeness of the pressure vessels at Flamanville. Unfortunately, the pressure vessel at Flamanville was inside its containment, so it can't be got at. So what they're going to do is they're going to use the production model for Hinkley Point C, the pressure vessel that's already been made, as a test piece. And this will put back, and that means it will be destroyed, and this will put back the manufacture of a new pressure vessel, the pressure vessel components, for about 3 or 4 years. So there's a big doubt now whether actually Hinkley Point, even if the order is confirmed and endorsed and sponsored by the Chinese, there's a big doubt that it could actually come online by 2023. And of course, if it misses the 2023 boat, effectively Britain runs into a calamity on the supply and demand of electrical generation and demand.
I notice also that Hinkley B is going to due to be decommissioned in 2025, so it's going to be a very narrow window to actually keep any kind of nuclear production going at Hinkley.
Well, there's some doubt whether Hinkley B will actually reach 2025. I mean, the Hinkley B reactors are what's called an advanced gas-cooled reactor. They're a development of the old Magnox reactors, and they were designed quite specifically for a 30-year life. And 30 years was up for Hinkley Point B in about 2006. So it means that they're stretching the serviceability envelope for Hinkley Point B well above what it was originally designed for. And there are significant problems with the AGRs as they age. And one, these are not reversible problems. You can't get into the AGR reactor to do an in-situ repair. You can't replace bits and pieces inside. And what's particularly worrying about the AGRs at Hinkley Point is a cracking that's developing in the graphite core, the moderator core inside the reactor pressure vessel, which is enormous. I mean, 20 meters in diameter. Inside there is a graphite moderator core, which is effectively, it slows the neutrons down so the nuclear process can go on. But really, well, it's just a loose stack of bricks, graphite bricks. And what's happening to those bricks is they're cracking. They're cracking vertically, So it's very difficult now for engineers to work out what the residual strength of that stack of bricks is inside the core, should there be a sudden pressure aberration going on, like a loss of coolant accident. What would happen to the core? Would it misalign and distort, trapping the fuel and causing a fuel meltdown and, you know, disaster scenarios like that? So there is some doubt whether Hinkley Point B will actually fulfil its 40-year life requirement.
Also, on this show last week from Stop Hinkley, Nikki Clark was telling us that the plutonium that comes from these factories, which is, I mean, she called it a bomb factory, it has to be replaced in the nuclear weapons every 3 or 4 years. I wonder what, you know, is that accurate, John?
No, that's a misunderstanding. I mean, first of all, there's a number of misunderstandings. First of all, the plutonium generated by the advanced gas cooled reactors in their fuel, look, to extract plutonium, you have to irradiate, in other words, put nuclear uranium fuel into a nuclear reactor. And this gives you a very small percent, less than 1% of plutonium in the irradiated, highly radioactive fuel that has to go to Sellafield to be reprocessed. The advanced gas cooled reactors are not particularly good plutonium breeders. So that's the first thing. And most of the plutonium that Britain uses was gained from the Magnox program, like Hinkley Point A. It was gained from those reactors, and it's fairly stable. In terms of once you've actually extracted the plutonium at Sellafield and gone through a series of refinements, the plutonium goes into the nuclear weapons called the fissile pit. And typically, the present generation of British nuclear weapons is got a shelf life, an operational shelf life, of about 12 to 14 years. So there's no need to replace the plutonium or to do any refinement of the plutonium in a British nuclear weapon for about 14 years. In fact, the thing that has to be replaced is what's called the tritium, which is another radioactive, a radionuclide, the tritium booster pack that actually gives the atomic part of a thermonuclear weapon a boost to get a lot more energy out of it.
So, what about the point about, is it a bomb factory, John?
Well, Hinkley Point, no. It was acknowledged by the old CEGB, the Central Electricity Generating Board, that up until the 70s, that the civil nuclear reactors, primarily the Magnox reactors, were part of the plutonium yield program. But since that time, Britain has such an enormous stockpile, well over 100 tonnes of plutonium. In fact, we have more plutonium than we need. And there's two stockpiles. There's the military stockpile, which is dedicated to the nuclear weapons. Then there's the civilian stockpile that's supposedly separated from the military stockpile. It's safeguarded against entering the nuclear weapons cycle. It's all part of the non-proliferation treaty. So you separate out the civilian material that comes from places like Hinkley Point A, used to, and Hinkley Point B, and for that, the nuclear industry is planning, although not particularly successfully, planning to actually use that in an adapted form, a pressurized water reactor called a MOX fueled reactor, a mixed oxide fueled reactor. So the industry has laid aside plans to actually use the surplus uranium yields that it gets from the irradiated fuel coming from nuclear power plants like Hinkley B and also from Hinkley C, if the fuel contracts are signed.
What about Fukushima? That's another thing that's on everyone's minds at the moment. I wonder what your thoughts are about what's happened here. We've had news just this week that it looks like there's a large amount of nuclear fuel which has disappeared, and people are suggesting that possibly that fuel has somehow melted down. What's your analysis of what's been going on over in Japan?
Well, it's quite clear what's happened to Fukushima. Effectively, there were six nuclear power plants at Fukushima. Three of those were operational and utterly destroyed during the tsunami events, the post-tsunami events. One other reactor, reactor number four, unit four, that was destroyed, although it was defueled at the time, it was destroyed because it was coupled to another reactor, unit three. What happened in Fukushima was that the earthquake occurred, and the reactors quite properly shut themselves down. The earthquake destroyed the local electricity grid. The the number of pylons that you see going into any power station. When the power plants close down, they're dependent upon the external electricity supplies to actually run their pumps to maintain cooling. And a nuclear reactor has to be cooled for days and weeks, in fact years, after it's closed down. So you have to use electrical supply. So what happened was the earthquake came along, it destroyed, the reactors closed down, as they do automatically under a seismic shake. The earthquake was so severe it destroyed a lot of the grid system, the electrical distribution system. So the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi went on their electrical generators, their emergency generators. These are big banks of diesels that run generators to supply that electricity required for the pumps inside the station. That was fine. That was running for about 40 minutes. Everything was fine. The reactors were being cooled. Things were under control. And then the tsunami hit. And the tsunami then flooded the site, because it's a coastal site, and they put the generators out of action. And then after that, that was 40 minutes after the earthquake, after that, three of the reactors melted down, and the meltdown occurred within 40 minutes of the tsunami striking, and within 40 minutes, the fuel cores, those three fuel cores, were committed to melting down. Within 6 hours, they'd melted completely. The fuel itself, about 100 tons of fuel, had slumped into the bottom of the reactor pressure vessel, and then it began to burn its way through the 150 millimeters or so of reactor pressure vessel steelwork. And then after about 18 hours, it slumped onto the concrete floor of the containment inside the reactors inside a containment. And what then happened was, the red-hot molten fuel ran at about 1300 degrees C, which of course is generating heat because of its radioactive decay. It then started reacting with the concrete floor and of the containment, and it caused generated carbon dioxide gas, which is a non-compressible, non-condensable gas. In other words, once you've got a pressure of it, you can't cool it to reduce the pressure. And that pressure of non-condensable gases then ruptured the containment. We saw on reactor 1, unit 1 and unit 3, it blew the roof off the containment. And the interesting one was unit 2, where the explosion breached the underground part of the containment. That unit 2 has let in a lot of groundwater, and the groundwater has washed over the slumped reactor core, which is called corium, this molten fuel core. And of course that is a transport mechanism to take, via the water, to take lots of radioactivity, a tremendous amount of radioactivity actually, into the ocean, into the marine environment.
Well, that's really worrying, John. I mean, what are your thoughts about the possibility of that actually, you know, spreading around that part of the world? Because once it's in the sea, it could go anywhere.
Well, what happens is you can see what the mechanisms are, because if you get it into the sea, these are tiny particles of fission products, radioactive products. Things like filter feeders, molluscs and things like that, they actually, and fish, they will gobble this up as protein. They can't distinguish between iodine, natural iodine, and iodine-131, radioactive iodine, or cesium and radioactive cesium. So they gobble it up, they reconcentrate it in their organs, and they become radioactive. And of course, if humans then start eating the clams and things like that, they become radioactive. They take in the radioactive food. So, you know, typically a fish can reconcentrate the amount of radioactivity in the sea surrounding it by about 15,000 to 20,000 times. A clam, a filter feeder, can do it 100,000 times. So you can, by this natural process, going through the food chain, contaminate the human population. Another problem is this, is the tidal line. If you have radioactivity, the flotsam and jetsam of radioactivity from a reactor contaminated the sea, things like seaweed, etc., as the tide comes in, it leaves an intertidal deposit. We've all walked along the beach and seen the debris along at the tide end. And of course, the intertidal deposit dries out between tides, and then you get onshore and offshore winds blowing the dried out particles, they become air suspended again, and they can then contaminate, as an airborne dispersion, contaminate local seaside communities. So it's a very complex mechanism by which the radioactivity can leave the reactor once the containment's broken, get into the marine environment, and then become atmospherically dispersed again.
What are your thoughts about the way the Japanese government and TEPCO have coped with, and have they been honest with the public about this disaster?
Well, we saw panic, we saw lack of planning, and we saw the consequences of lack of planning. The consequences of not recognising that catastrophic events can occur. The Japanese nuclear safety regulators have taken much the same stance that's adopted universally, internationally, by regulators, including our own regulator, the Office for Nuclear Regulation, that you can actually, it's within our wit to actually predict the frequency and severity of accidents. In other words, we convince ourselves that we can say how often very severe accidents will occur. And we say, if the frequency of a severe accident is, say, a million, once in a million years, then we can say that accident is so remote we can consider it incredible, so we don't have to plan for it. So in other words, we say, of course you can have an earthquake and a tsunami, but it would be so remote it's not worth planning for it because it will never happen. Or you could say, I know black swans exist in New Zealand, but I'm never likely to see one. So in other words, I can take no account of it. I don't have to take account of it. And that was a problem. That was a problem in Japan, was that the nuclear regulator became convinced that its forecasting of what could happen, the severity and frequency of the events, it didn't put in place proper contingency plans to counter those events. And that event, of course, was a tsunami, an earthquake. And of course, in Britain, it may not necessarily be an earthquake or a tsunami, or it could be a tsunami, it may not be a tsunami. What it could be is the accident and severity that we hadn't thought of. Well, that's the real question here.
That's the commercial nuclear world, which is rather more open than the military world. One does worry, doesn't one, about the amount of stockpiles of plutonium and whether that stuff ever goes missing. Because I know there's certainly been reports about nuclear weapons even being dumped in the sea under difficult circumstances and then not being able to be retrieved. I mean, do you think there are nuclear weapons out there that have gone missing?
Well, there's certainly nuclear weapons that have been dumped in the sea. I mean, I worked on a submarine called the Komsomolets, a Russian Federation submarine that sunk in 1989, and she had four nuclear weapons on board. The Americans have lost a submarine with some nuclear weapons on board. So, yes, of course. And, of course, there's been some aircraft crashes where nuclear weapons have been lost, at Palomares in Spain. There were four nuclear weapons jettisoned, and those were all recovered slowly, but two of them caught fire and had a contamination. There was another serious nuclear weapon loss at Thule in Greenland, and so on and so forth. So, you know, if you play with fire, you're bound to burn your fingers.
Certainly, gamma radiation burns nasty. But, I mean, you worked, didn't you, on a program back in, I think it was 1993, with Roger Cook called Dirty Bomb, and that was looking at the post-Soviet era in Russia and surrounding countries, and there were a lot of military people that hadn't been paid, and yet they were in charge of nuclear weapons. And I know as part of that program, Roger was actually offered weapons-grade plutonium. Just tell us, I mean, am I right in thinking you were involved in that program?
Yes, yeah. Well, we put together a suitcase bomb, actually, a model of one, I would add.
And what, I mean, that does, it just seemed to indicate that actually this kind of, you know, very dangerous weapons-grade plutonium was available on the black market, for goodness sake.
Well, it's not necessarily, it's the responsibilities of the nuclear states to make sure that proliferation in any form doesn't go ahead. And the real problem becomes if a subnational terrorist group, with the backing of a state, can acquire a weapon and acquire the means of detonating it, then we have a major problem. And that is causing serious concern generally among all the super states, because the super states, and I mean the super states like Russia, United States, Britain, France, etc., are see themselves as potential targets for that sort of action. So one could see the question of weak links in the proliferation controls as a means by which terrorists could create a devastating effect on a country. The other option is, of course, is to use the existing nuclear facilities themselves to create the same radiological havoc by using the pent-up, the locked-up energy of a nuclear reactor to trigger into a release situation. So in other words, one of the problems with nuclear power plants is that in the past they've been designed primarily to counter accidents. Excuse me. They've been designed primarily to resist accidental events. That's unintelligent accidental events. What has changed in the last decade is we now know that nuclear power plants are considered to be viable targets by some terrorist groups. So now they are potentially not going to be subjected to an accidental event, which is an unintelligent, random event. They could be subjected to an intelligent, intentional event that seeks out the vulnerabilities of the plant. Now, if the plants were not designed in the first place to actually resist intentional, intelligent events, then we have a problem. And many of the plants, not just in Britain, but in internationally across the world, were never designed to resist terrorism.
You seem to be saying, John, that this technology is inherently unsafe. Is there any real possibility of actually reining the technology back now? It's like Pandora's box has been opened.
No, there are a number of technologies that are inherently risky and have hazards. So nuclear power is not the only one. There are many. As we probe into advanced technology, then we have to take risks. It's the problem is, it, to my mind, is who should judge whether that risk is acceptable? Should it be the state without that much consultation with the people, or should it be the people with some consultation with the state? And at the moment, it's clearly the state makes the decision on our behalf. It says what it considers to be a tolerable, what it considers to be an acceptable risk of accident or incident, and what it considers to be tolerable consequences. It really doesn't consult the public on what risk it would want to take and what consequences it would wish to bear in terms of an accident. And that's really what's wrong here. Is the public should determine what the acceptable risk is and what tolerable consequences are.
What do you think the relative risks are of some sort of unintended use of a nuclear weapon compared with that of a power station? Because, maybe we've just been lucky over the last 70 years or so that it's only been the nuclear power stations that we've had accidents with.
Well, who knows? I mean, it's a determined... if you have a determined person, individual, then who knows? I mean, What's the saying? The state has to be lucky all the time. The terrorist has to be lucky just once.
Okay, retired nuclear engineer John Large, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
I'm joined now in the studio to talk about the housing crisis by Marion Shaw. Hi, Marion. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Good to be here.
First of all, tell us a bit about your role at the Council of Protection for Rural England, because I understand it was there that you wrote your book about land rights, a historical book.
Well, I actually got caught up in the environment movement in the 1970s and got very concerned about the way in which modern farming during the 70s and 80s was affecting the English countryside. And I joined the Council for the Protection of Rural England and worked at their national office. And then after a while I left because I got some money to do some in-depth research about all that. And that led on to a book about land ownership, because I could see that actually what was fundamental to all this was the way in which land had been apportioned in this country and the sort of motives that landowners had for land and how that had an effect on the rest of the population and also on wildlife and so on. And then later on became very interested in access to the countryside and wrote a further book after This Land Is Our Land called A Right to Roam.
So how did we end up here? This is what I'm interested in, where we've got a situation where, I mean, whatever, you know, whichever creed you're coming from, the earth is a free gift to us all, and yet we've come to this crazy situation now where very many of us either are having to rent somewhere to live or from a private landlord or social housing. Actually, roundabout, I mean, I was looking at the figures earlier this week trying to figure out, and the ballpark figure is about 1 million people across the country don't have a permanent place to live or are living in overcrowded accommodation, that sort of thing. To have so many people without anywhere to live almost sounds medieval. So how did we come from this situation where most people, you know, hundreds of years ago did have somewhere to live, to the situation now where they don't?
Well, it's a very complicated situation, Tony. I mean, all sorts of factors in the housing situation now, and it's quite difficult to disentangle what's happening there. But I mean, I'm quite encouraged by the fact that we're now supposed to be with the new leadership in the Labour Party having some debate about what some of the radical alternatives might be to things like the housing crisis or indeed other matters, and I hope that we will have some radical thinking, because I mean, there are some obvious sort of solutions that you could take on board and discuss, and they don't tend to have been discussed in the past, really, because in recent years both sides of the political spectrum have been really quite conservative and terribly worried about upsetting voters.
Well, also upsetting landowners. But the whole progress of enclosure over the centuries, I mean, when I first picked up your book, I'm trying to think when it was, probably somewhere around the mid-1990s, It took me nearly 2 or 3 months to get hold of a copy of it, because going through the Interlibrary Loan Service couldn't actually get a copy, and there were two people wanted to read your book before I did, so it took a while. Yeah. But when I finally got around to it, what I found, I think, most fascinating was the chapters about the enclosure of land, because actually, if you go around Somerset, for example, Gloucestershire, Wiltshire, around here, quite often on the map, you'll see site of such and such village. You'll see a little, you know, where all you've got left is a few humps and bumps where there used to be a village. And many of our ancestors were just simply kicked off the land, weren't they? And in fact, this goes back to what we were talking about in the first hour, actually, to do with livestock, because they were removed, evicted, given sometimes a compensation of something like a barrel of beer instead of the land they used to have, and told to go on their way, and replaced with sheep. So the enclosure movement, it was over several hundred years, and accelerated by the English Civil War, because of course the merchant classes in the form of Cromwell took over from the old feudal classes as part of that battle. Just take us through, if you can, a bit of the enclosures over the centuries.
Sure. First of all, I'm sorry you couldn't get hold of my book way back then. In fact, it came out soon after the time you're talking about. I mean, there was a new edition published, and of This Land Is Our Land, and indeed, if people want to buy a copy, they can get one from me through looking me up on the internet, Marion Shaud.
What's your website?
It's www.marionshaud, all one word, that's MarionShaord .co.uk. But okay. if you just get Google my name, you should
or
get
your
it.
Other favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, who are in the pay of the National Security Agency.
I'm sorry. Yeah, okay.
But anyway, to enclosure. Yeah, when did it start? When did it finish? Just take us through it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you have to go back quite a long way. And, I mean, this is a situation that you see in many different countries across the world throughout history that, I mean, land is a very valuable resource. You know, we need it to build shelters, to grow food, to use it as a space for all sorts of activities. And, of course, it's only limited in supply and there's a struggle over it. And that's been a characteristic for a very long time. And what happened in this country was, if you go back to way back Anglo-Saxon times, everything was fairly okay and people had a reasonable amount of access to land for farming and wandering around and generally living. But then there was the Battle of Hastings, and when William the Conqueror came over to this country, he seized the land. And what he did with it was he kept some of it for himself, and then he parcelled the remainder out to his favoured barons, the people who'd supported him at the battle. And that was the sort of basis of feudalism, and these people held land. I mean, some of our big landowners can trace their status way back to that time. I mean, the Duke of Westminster, for instance, one of our richest people in this country, supposed to be worth £7 billion. I mean, he was given land in Cheshire then, and he was he was supporting William at the Battle of Hastings.
Well, this is called, isn't it, the Norman yoke? Is it fair to call it a yoke? You know, it's one of those things you have to put on your shoulders to carry around forevermore.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't think the Duke of Westminster had to do that. And anyway, so you had this land being apportioned out. You had people carrying on sort of farming it, and there was sort of obligation to these people that they could carry on using the land, and they could move around. There was fairly good free access, and although there were certain things that were imposed, I mean, these Norman barons were very keen on hunting, and so they sort of allocated bits of land, certainly the king did, and later the barons, as royal forests where farming was controlled, so that they could have lots of fun galloping around doing their hunting. What actually happened was, it was really as you get towards Tudor times that landowners started to want to not have that sort of system. They wanted to make money from their land. So you get sort of you get capitalism being introduced and land being seen as a source of wealth. And that's when you started getting the enclosures that you've mentioned, because to make it to get some money out of land, or more money, what they wanted to do was to have more exclusive use and sort of push off the people who had been using it in the past. And that's what enclosure was all about. And it was at its starkest really in Scotland, because at least in this side of the border there were some kind of parliamentary controls, not very strong, but that sought to assert the public interest against the power of the landowners. But in Scotland they didn't have that, and so you got the very famous Highland clearances, where people were pushed off the land that their families had occupied for generations, and many of them of course emigrated to the New World.
There's also Martin Summers, there's also the Irish angle on this, isn't there, where they had the Irish Land League over there in the 1800s or 1880s roundabout, and what part do you think that played in the Irish Rebellion that then took place during World War One a bit later? Because it just seemed that there was a great deal of resentment about the English landowners owning Irish estates, and of course many of people in the 1880s still had families that remembered what had happened in the Irish famines.
Well, I think the difference between Scotland and Ireland is that the resistance of the people on the land was stronger, and they managed to maintain their their right to be on it, and you've still got a very active, you know, small farming community, especially in the west of Ireland. But of course, in large sections of modern Scotland are denuded of any kind of local farming at all. It's the grouse moors and so on.
So, Marion, after the Civil War, this all really accelerated. And now I think, I'm maybe wrong, but I think there's only one town in Britain, in Nottinghamshire, Laxton, which hasn't been enclosed, which I visited probably 10 years ago, which has got a different sort of feel to it. It's quite interesting. It's, you can wander around wherever you want in the fields around the village, and it's still using the previous system. But this also was tied up, I suppose, with the Industrial Revolution, because you had a lot of people removed from the land, particularly in the 1700s, and then finding, well, we're going to have to go and work in a factory.
That's right. I mean, they found themselves driven off the land. They couldn't make a living from the land, and then, of course, industrialisation was happening, and they moved to the towns and cities, and then they started forgetting about what their rights had been in the countryside, or what they claimed their rights had been. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Laxton, because, I mean, what we also have a survival of the pre-feudal system in common land, and that was a sort of basic part of the system way back in Anglo-Saxon times, which survived the Norman period, and that was land that anybody could use, I mean, for grazing, for gathering mushrooms, nuts, fishing and so on. And you'd have that in the various parishes. And what the landowners wanted to do when they enclosed land was to get rid of all that. But they didn't succeed in getting rid of it all. And you've still got quite a lot of common land around the place. And that...
I'm thinking about... So one place I drive through from time to time is Minchinhampton Common near Stroud, definitely. Where you quite often find cows kind of stood in the middle of the road challenging you, as if to say, look, you're going to have to go up on the grass if you want to get past me.
Yeah. That's right. It's a lovely place, Minchinhampton Common. But I mean, actually, it's a very good illustration of the way in which, although you had this really quite stark, brutal system over many years, there have at various times been there've been protests. I mean, lots of protests, but in some cases, they've actually managed to get somewhere, and you've got some kind of survival of common land. But also in our own time, because nowadays, of course, those people who move to towns and cities, they often want to use the countryside for recreation. When the government, way back in the year 2000, and responsible in this case only for England and Wales, decided that they wanted to give people greater rights of access to the countryside, it was common land that they focused on, amongst other types of land, to give people a right of access, because they felt that access to the land for recreation should be to some extent a free good available to everybody. And so you've got this sort of social contract that exists between landowners and the rest of us, and over time it's changed a bit. But I mean, in our own time, one of the elements of that is this right of access, although alas, in England and Wales, the land involved covers only about 10% of the land surface, because the government of the day was a bit timid and decided that the land covered should only be certain categories of land that would be mapped, and there isn't much of it in this part of the world, alas. It's things like mountain moorland, heathland, downland, common land, and also coastland is being added. But I mean, if you look at the amount of land covered as access land in this part of the world, it's only about 1% of the surface. I mean, that's also alongside public rights of way, of course, which is another element of the sort of social contract that's been built up over the years.
Well, at least it's better than man traps, which used to be laid down by big landowners and would grab your leg in a giant great vice and almost kill you, probably. So that we've moved on from there anyway.
We have, but there are still quite a few trespassers will be prosecuted signs around the place.
Yeah, they're threatening.
No, not quite.
In fact, whenever I see one, I usually just hop over the fence and hop back again just to make the point. You know?
But the exciting thing is that actually in Scotland, they went much further in terms of access. And in 2003, one of the first acts of the new Scottish Parliament was the enactment of a general right of access to the countryside. And so they didn't sort of just limit it to this partial right that we've got in England and Wales, where you've only got certain land covered. I mean, so up there, you've got a general presumption that people can wander around and not be treated as trespassers in all sorts of land. I mean, it's a right of responsible access, so you mustn't do harm. But if you, you know, you can, it's not just, you know, reserved for like the glens and the mountains. It's ordinary land on the edge of Glasgow and Edinburgh. You can walk along field edges. You can walk along the tram lines through the crops. You can walk in woodland. So it's a general, and also along rivers and streams, burns and so on, which is terribly important.
That sounds like they're way ahead of us as civilization.
But the exciting thing is now we've got this new Labour leadership, and they should be looking again at these sort of more radical alternatives and thinking, well, if they do it in Scotland, why on earth can't we have it down here and up there? You know, there was a lot of concern. The landowners were saying, and the owners of the grass moors all know it's going to be disastrous. It's all going to, you know, going to get terrible problems. In fact, you know, there's been a committee of the Scottish government, sorry, the committee of the Scottish Parliament, which has shown that actually it's all working really well. And there, you know, there aren't, none of the stakeholders are urging radical reform of the thing. So it's bedded down pretty well up there. And so I hope that the new people like, you know, Kerry McCarthy, with her responsibility for agriculture, which will presumably also take in this kind of thing, will think and think again about access and think of something a bit more radical along the lines of the Scottish approach.
Well,
down here.
I mean, it certainly seems a good principle, doesn't it? That you know, you can walk wherever you want unless there's a good reason why you shouldn't be.
That's
there.
Right. That's right.
It's just a basic thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really? We were talking about something similar earlier, in fact, weren't we? What about, okay, it's all very well having somewhere to walk, but what about somewhere to live? Because that's where there's the big problem at the moment. What are your thoughts about what we can do about that? Because this is the knotty problem. I mean, in London now, we're talking about, I mean, I was just doing gave the calculation at the top of the hour. It's something like 100 times more per week or per month you're paying for a house than it actually would cost to build it. I mean, just getting rid of the price of the land, which is a whole nother racket in itself. You know, you know, people who are actually, rather than putting their money in the bank now because they're getting no interest, they're buying up land just as money in the bank, and they're quite often leaving properties empty.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, just as in the countryside, you've got these sort of two nations. You've got people who own land, and as a result have a lot of wealth because land is worth a lot of money and it's increasing in value. And of course, the more money they get, the more land they can buy, or the more, you know, or other things they can buy. So under the agricultural support system, you've got people like the Duke of Westminster and the Queen being given a load of money because under the single payment scheme, because they just get this payment through the European Union just because they are there owning land. And it's a crazy situation. But in the housing situation too, you've got a kind of a similar sort of situation. You've got a sort of two housing nation. You've got the housing deprived, and you've also got the housing very rich, because you've got some people who've happened to have bought housing at the right time, who have benefited from the increase in the price of housing, and they can then buy more housing and then let it out to people. Or in London, certainly, you get these foreigners coming over and buying housing and then even leaving it empty. And, you know, there's all that to tackle too.
Martin, we've got this crazy situation, haven't we? We've got a government that is absolutely obsessed with the idea of keeping house prices going up and up and up, a little bit all the time. Almost like a ratchet system. What's the logic of that from their point of view economically? Why do they constantly want to keep house prices going up no matter how much it costs to build a house?
Well, the logic of that is that if you think about the way the electoral system works, the swing voters in certain constituencies, there's several hundred thousand people that decide British elections, and they tend to be homeowners, and they of course the big landowners like the Duke of Westminster, they rake it in whatever happens. They're another level altogether. But the system actually favours for example, the right to buy that's been put forward, it really is to help potential Tory voters in those swing constituents.
So there's an electoral aspect.
So there's an electoral aspect.
What about the economic reason?
Well, the economic.
Why does George Osborne looking at the house prices and going, "Oh, they're going up. That's good."
Well, no, I would argue that in actual fact, the obsession with personal home ownership in Britain has actually led to macroeconomic failures. So what the classic problem get in Britain is stop and go in the economy. What they call stop go. In actual fact, it's go stop. So what happens is the southeast of England, as the economy picks up, as it has been over the last couple of years, house prices shoot ahead
in the southeast of England. What I think you've just almost made something dawn in my mind there is that, well, it doesn't matter what's happening with wages and things like that. If the government can look at house prices and say, well, they're going up and up and up, they can say, well, actually, the economy's recovering. Well, it's doing well.
Because
asset prices are going up.
Yes, and it certainly pleases those who own assets, who tend to be the dominant force in the society. And so then, of course, what then happens is traditionally you have to raise interest rates, although that hasn't happened this time because of other reasons. And that means that, for example, when you've got industry north of the Wash in Scotland and the north of England, they have to face a high interest payments to borrow money, so that because they're using rising interest rates to control the property bubble in the southeast. And we've been through this cycle several times in my lifetime, and basically it's a racket whereby there's an inflationist block in the southeast of England which determines the elections, which makes money. We had the UKIP councillor on here who both bought his own council house. He's made several hundred thousand pounds on that. That's a gift from society to him.
Marion, I know you're looking at some sort of solutions to this at the moment. What are your thoughts about what can be done anyway?
Well, I think some of the, I mean, as you've just said, the big problem about this is that some of the most obvious solutions, make people squeal, make some of the voters squeal, and it's those that even people like Jeremy Corbyn are worried about. And they've got to convince voters as a whole that these things are worth doing. I mean, I've always thought, housing isn't particularly my area of expertise. Mine is rural land more, and farming and landscape and access and so on. But I mean, things like the relief on capital gains tax for primary residences, so that if I've got a house that's worth £300,000 and I sell it and buy something that's worth £200,000, I pretty well keep all that capital gain. And I'm just, I can benefit because I just happened to get in there earlier at a time when house prices were going up, so I've got a lot of money. I mean, if you remove that exemption, then you'd release a lot of money, I think.
What about
the price of housing down.
What about land tax, Marion?
Well, the land tax that I have advocated in This Land Is Our Land is something really more for rural land, and it is based on the idea that landowners can charge for others to farmland or whatever is not something that they've ever created. They just happen to get there first, and they can kind of bleed everyone else and have this one-way flow of resources just because they happen to say, right, I'm here and I own the land.
Well, so that's why they probably chased whoever was on there before off with a gun or a sword or something,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah, and what they can do is say, okay, that's mine, I've got all this lovely rent coming in, and at the same time, if land increases in value because somebody builds a railway station or something next to it, that increase in value won't be anything that they've done, it won't be worth anything they've done, but they can still benefit from that land increase in land value. Now, my idea in This Land Is Our Land was to introduce a rural land tax scheme, but to actually use it as an instrument of public policy. I think it's really weird that taxation isn't used more as an instrument of public policy in a more obvious and precise way. But what you could do is you could tax profitable activities, you could tax farming and so on, and it would be a tax on the owners, not the tenants, so it should bring down the price of land a bit.
Well, that's interesting, because you're also, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm also thinking there about the way council tax has taken over from the old rates in the cities. And yeah, I know we had on this show recently Anna Minton, who's written a book called Ground Control, Privatisation of Public Space in Cities. We're also talking earlier on about fencing off parks for
commercial events, this sort of thing. But anyway, so do you think we're ever going to, this is a sort of to round up, Marion, are we ever going to be in a situation where everybody gets what they want, which is effectively security of tenure, isn't it? We don't want to have someone knocking on the door, or even the threat of it, telling us we've got to get out on the street with our possessions.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, it would be very good if every. I mean, but housing is a very complicated thing, and the more housing you create, you know, if the more housing you create, say in Southeast England, the more people are going to move to the Southeast of England, and the less likely businesses are to relocate to the North of England. I mean, it's a very in a way, housing shortage is an instrument of regional policy, and it's quite complicated.
Overcrowded?
Sorry?
Is it fair to say Britain is overcrowded?
Well, I think it's a very crowded country, but I think it's also a country in which, and my concern is that we don't share the benefits, particularly of the land, that we ought to.
Okay, just remind us of your website again, Marion.
Yeah, it's www.marionshaward, marionshaard.co.uk.
It's been fascinating chatting to you. Time to sign off now, though, for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock on our sister show Dialect here on BCFM next Tuesday at noon. A Bristol plane spotter gives his theories about two Israeli Air Force Hercules planes leaving Paris Charles de Gaulle Airport the morning after Princess Diana was killed. Thanks to all our guests this week. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. You can download shows to listen to in your car. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down.
On your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for